Hello and welcome to episode 77 of the Payers and Players podcast. My name is Robert. I'm here with Scott. We've got an awesome guest for this episode. Scott, why don't you introduce our guest?
Sure. We got Matthias Marin. He is the director of tennis at Tucker Tennis Academy in Tulsa, Oklahoma. As a junior, he grew up in Rosario, Argentina, where he made top 50 as an ITF in the ITF rankings. And college, he played at Baylor, where his team won a national championship. And Matthias was the clinching match, which he did against UCLA. Professionally, he got as high as 998 in the rankings, and he recently attended the World Cup where he saw Argentina bring home the title. So, Matthias, what was more fun, Argentina in the World Cup or winning the national championship at Baylor?
How are you guys? Thank you for having me. That's a tough question. I mean, I want to say Argentina, but I can't forget about my Baylor Bears. So two unique experiences that, you know, I wouldn't change them for anything.
So I'm curious about the World Cup. I know this is a tennis podcast, but the World Cup is such a unique and popular event throughout the world. What's it like going there, and how do you sort of deal with it? Because, you know, it's like games aren't every day. So, you know, how do you spend your time there, and how did you navigate that?
I'd tell you briefly how this whole thing happened. So I've been trying to go to a World Cup for quite a while now, they're every 4 years. So I've been trying to get tickets, and it was nearly almost impossible to get them. So I said, okay, whatever, you know, we watch on TV with my family and all that. So when Argentina wins round of 16, it's on a Friday against Australia. So the next day, my house is pretty quiet at night, and I just start going online and looking for airfares with miles I have saved and hotels and all that and points. And every time I've done doing that, then, okay, yeah, I can get a flight, you know, from Dallas to there for decent number of miles. And the same with the hotels. And things were starting to click. And I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. So, and I just saved everything just in case. And then you need a permit to get into Qatar. So, that it takes 5 days. So I said, oh, this is it. No, there's always something that, you know, blocks you from the trip. So I started calling them the next day. I said, look, how can you expedite this? And they said, well, sir, it takes 5 days, blah, blah, blah. So I started digging in and call them every day. And so I have everything on hold and said, look, if I get it, I need to leave on a Wednesday to get there by Thursday because Argentina was playing on Friday. So against Netherlands. So I'm teaching, and a Friday afternoon, I get this email that say, yeah, you've been approved. So that same day and night, I book everything, bought my tickets for that game on a website. And then I said, okay, I'm going to go for 5 days, you know. And also England, France were playing on Saturday, so I booked tickets for that game. And I said, look, I fly Wednesday, get there on Thursday, watch Argentina, Netherlands, watch France, England. Sunday and Monday, I'm around Doha and Qatar. I've never been in that part of the world. And then, yeah, so that was a trip. But then all of a sudden, I met some friends from Argentina over there. There was many of them. And they say, you can't leave now. Are you crazy? We're in the semifinals. I said, I know, but I got to go back to work. I mean, I actually literally went with a backpack with 5 shirts and that's it, you know, nothing on it. So, well, this guy ended up convincing me together, you know, with my wife, friends and all that. And so I said, okay, I stayed for the semifinals. I was able to get tickets, people at the club supporting me, and now I was now sharing the stories, and now the club became a big Argentinian fan through all that. And I understand, so short story, you know, I understand for 2 weeks, watch the semifinals, watch the finals, went around Doha, did all kind of, you know, tourism stuff, learned a lot about the culture, and it was unbelievable. So, I don't know. For people that know me, they know I'm more on the structure side of things. So to get this kind of thing spontaneous and doing it for something that I have a lot of passion, like is soccer, and the way the whole story ended up in Argentina winning it and the crazy games and everything. So kind of a little bit of a lucky true story. So yeah, in between days, I mean, you just go around the city and, you know, and just get to know. I like to explore things when I'm there and get to know how it's different from what we do, you know, from here in the US or even, you know, back in Argentina. So it was unbelievable. I mean, a lot of people from Argentina as well there, so for that event. So something that we'll never forget. And when I came back, I mean, talking to my wife, I said, okay, what trip are we going to have that is going to beat this? And I said, I don't know. I leave that up to you. So we'll see.
Well, you can always leave it up to Scott to come up with a question as he introduces a guest about a trip that has nothing to do with tennis that was that exciting. I had no idea. I remember asking Everett about it. I said, what's Matias up to? And he said, he's at the World Cup. And I was like, at the World Cup? And he said, yeah, but that, what a cool trip. I mean, that's exciting. And Scott, how in the world did you even know to ask that?
I followed Matias on Instagram, saw that he was over there. Looked like he was having a good time. And I thought it was interesting because, you know, at a tennis tournament, if you go to Wimbledon, you go for 2 weeks, you can see matches every day. But if you go to the World Cup, you're there for a month and you see like four matches or something. So I think it's a really unique fan experience and how to deal with all the downtime. But like you say, you just got to be an explorer. And, you know, if it's someplace you haven't been before, you know, you just make the most of it. So that was, I think that's a great story. And like you say, yeah, you're not spontaneous. You're probably a lot like me. You're very structured, but sometimes you get swept up in something and you just go with the flow and it works out.
Yeah. It's meant to be. It's funny because I was leaving the club. I remember that Tuesday and I was telling one of the Brazilian coaches now also that the love soccer, say I'm leaving tomorrow to the World Cup, and she go, oh yeah, sure, see you tomorrow. I say no, and I kind of left, and then she texts me the next day, yo, you're really at Qatar now. I say yes, I was not kidding, but yeah, it was cool. You know, I had to, you know, stay in five different six hotels because everything was sold out, and just again, I was just me with no family, so it made things a lot easier in that way. You know that you can stay in many different places, but yeah. But yeah, it was a cool story. So yeah.
Well, Matias, tell us a little bit going to your junior career. Talk to us about when you were, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old. When did you start tennis? What did your training look like? Did your parents have to sacrifice to get you to an academy, or was there one in town? What did your junior career look like?
So I started tennis and soccer at the same time, probably about 5 years old. 5, 6 years old. There was a social club. There's a lot of social clubs in Argentina. So this one was 3 blocks from my house. And I started there. So I was not walking to the club, you know, 9 clay courts in there, all red clay, a bunch of soccer fields, a big swimming pool. And that was a place where we as a family hang out. You know, my parents would go and play tennis in the afternoons and sometimes cards, and I would just hang out there in the afternoon, you know. And as I started to develop the love for both games, you know, for both sports, then I just, everything was there. So, you know, my brother was playing soccer as well. So when things got a little more competitive, around, I would say, 12 to 13 years old. Now, at that point, I started playing tournament maybe around 9, 10. And again, on 12, 13, things started to get a little bit more competitive. I was playing in 2 different soccer teams and just playing all sectional and national events. And we did that for about 1 year. And so my dad told me, look, this is not working out for me. It's working out for you, but not for me. To the point that I would play half a soccer game for one team. Then I will change in the car, play the second half for the other team, and then maybe a tennis tournament that same weekend. So so now that I have to live a little bit of that with my kids that are playing soccer and tennis, I say, what was my dad thinking for a year? So yeah, I did both. And then, so I got to the point that I said, you had to choose one at that age, you know, 14, that's when it was. And I leaned toward tennis. I was traveling more. I was, you know, going around South America, and that kind of was a little more fun. And yeah, so, and then from there, I mean, I was always training in the same club. It was just a group of friends that, you know, after school program, I did my whole high school in regular schooling, meaning that they were super flexible with me traveling. So I would be 3 weeks on the road sometimes, and they would be okay with it. So, which is kind of unique in that regards. So then I started playing all the South American tournaments, national tournaments, and my ranking went up. And in Argentina, the way it works is by calendar year. So you play, you know, 2 years in the 12s, but it's just, you know, the calendar year, not on your birthday month. So then you have 2 and 14s, 2 and 16s. And then my first year of every age group, I struggle a lot. And then the second year, I will have a little more success. So I'm 16, then my second year 16, I started to, be top three in the nation. Now I qualified to play some of these South American events, the COSAT. And then I was able to qualify through those to go to Europe. So the South American Federation takes chooses two or six kids total, six boys, 6 girls, and then take it to a trip to Europe to play. So that was kind of my booming year, I would say, on the tennis. I said, okay, yeah, I want to be, a tennis player. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned the word sacrifice, and yeah, I mean, my parents, I say, make a lot of efforts, right? So together with my brother and all that, for me to be able to do these things, and that, as you guys know, it's not cheap and time consuming and all that, whatever comes with it. So yeah, that second year, that was 1998. That's when I was now playing, and I had a pretty good year. And in my age group in Argentina, I'm not 982s. I mean, they were phenomenal about players, from Guillermo Coria, who was top three in the world, David Nalbandian, top three in the world, José Acasuso, top 30 in the world, and some other guys that were top 100. So that was the guys I was playing growing up and competing against. So just to see, all those guys making it that far and all that, that was not, and I look back and I say, well, no, I was able to play with those guys and friends with some of them still today.
So Matias, take us back a little bit to those earlier days when you were at the tennis club, and talk about sort of what your weekly routine looked like in terms of, how many hours were on the court, what did you focus on? Is there anything maybe in the Argentina way of development that is different than in the U.S. and things like that?
Yes, I think it probably changed a lot now these days. I mean, everything tennis is more global and there are more things to do and all. No, I think coaching is a little bit different. But back in the day, I mean, until I was 15, 14, so I would have one private lesson a week with a coach. That it was key because we're working on technical stuff without me knowing that I was working on technical stuff, but also there was a lot of point play. So that kind of, for me, that was the best part of the lesson, not to compete against the coach and all that. But I was going to school, so the afternoon drills were 2 hours. We would play a lot of points. And the feeling was more racket-fed, I think, that hand-feeding. That I'm a big believer, I think, on hand-feeding, racket-feeding, based on the needs of the player. So yeah, it was kind of very simple in a way. No, we're a group of guys that was just boys, girls, all mixed up. There was a lot of ranking talks, not a lot about UTR talks, not a lot about WTN talks. That whole thing didn't exist. So we just trained that way at a local club. Now, as spin progresses and I turned 16, and like I was saying before, that year that my results explode a little bit, then I switched to another local club where the coach that I was working with just kind of switched. So it became a little bit more competitive, but kind of the same. So I would maybe do a little more 2 one-on-ones, but the group of players that were in that club were a little bit more competitive until it got to the point that, yes, at the age of 17, I moved to Buenos Aires to train with the National Federation. And that's when the big decision of leaving my house and just staying in a dorm, basically, at the National Tennis Center, which is not like the USTA Orlando Center. It's a nice club, but I was living underneath the main stadium where they play Davis Cup. When there is there's no Wi-Fi, there is no TV. It was just me and another guy, and which was back in the day. I look at it, it was fun. We're there sleeping at the stadium, get up, train, and all day long there with the top coaches and players in the nation. So there was a lot of growing for me at that time, and tennis part, and as well as a little kid from that was not from Buenos Aires to move there. So and that's when you talk about sacrifices, it's not only financial sometimes. I think from my family and a lot of families, not that to let the kid go, it's not easy. So I'm grateful for that my parents support me in that way, to say, hey, you want to do this? We'll support you, but this is no, this is your pathway.
And so you graduate. I mean, you move there, you train there, and then eventually something happened for you to get noticed where you could go play at Baylor. Because, like you said, no UTR. Did you say you were in the you were a 1982?
Yes.
So you and I are the exact same age. I'm 1982 as well. So you're finishing 18. Cell phones are just starting to come out. I mean, the big bag phones are in cars, but there's no, you know, handheld cell phone that everybody's carrying around. How in the world did you find Baylor?
That's a good question. So I knew very, very little about college. So there was a girl that was a couple years older than me that I trained with, that she decided to go to play college in the US. And at that time, I mean, I was a little younger. I didn't pay attention. I didn't know what she was doing. I was, you know, on my own world a little bit. And then when I age up to 18s, you know, in 16s, I got the chance to play the Junior Davis Cup for Argentina. So now I'm getting to know, you know, a lot of the international players. So and this team, I mean, it's not three players. We went to Italy, and you're playing all of a sudden. When I look back, you know, we lost to Spain. Well, and the team on Spain, it was David Ferrer, Mark Lopez, and Tommy Robredo. So when you look at that team, I mean, incredible talent, you know. And then the U.S. was Andy Roddick and Eric Nunez and Tres Davis. So the guys that actually they make, you know. So all that then shifting to the 18s, you know. Now I'm playing also the South American. You know, now we're playing ITFs and all that, trying to see, you know, if the dream of playing a junior slam, you know, you're not thinking college, you know. It's at least back in those days, maybe now it's different, but you know, when you're there, either we're training to try to get in the junior slams at that level or to transition to pros. Now you're playing, you know, 15Ks or 10Ks back in the day, or satellites even, you know, in those moments. So this girl, friend of mine, that said, look, Matias, there is a chance, I know, if you want to go to the US, that, you know, for sure schools will be interested in you. And I said, look, I'm playing this. I was about to go to the French Open juniors. I had someone that was helping me with the covered expenses and all that. So I go to Europe, play the French, actually qualify and play, an amazing experience. And I stayed there for 3, 4, 5 tournaments, and I came back to play a pro event, and then I don't have that support anymore. And so this is not August of 2000. And I already graduated from a school, you know, 6 months ago. I know you finished school in December. So I only have like 4 months if I want to come. I had to come in January. I had, you know, back in the day, you have a year that you can go to college. So I talked to the Argentinian Federation. I said, look, I think I want to have the chance to maybe go play in the US. I want to at least have conversations. And they were the one that said, look, we have connections with X amount of schools. We can send an email or something at that time. And that's how the connection started. So again, they're between Baylor, Louisville, Oregon, and Michigan were the four that they were calling, you know, the fixed line in my house. My English was non-existent. My parents until this day don't speak any English, so they would call, you know, you're fixed. There's not even an email and stuff. So it's like they would call and I understood maybe 10% of what they were saying and all that. So it was not the process. Okay, I didn't have a time to make an official visit, because now, you know, these coaches are trying to tell Matias, you gotta take the SAT, you gotta take this. I'll say, okay, so this girl, this friend helped me and all that. So all of a sudden, okay, I'm in this process of getting all this accomplished. So I do all that. And before I can start getting, okay, we can give you this scholarship and all that. So Baylor got my attention, to be honest, was the most Hispanic of all the four locations. As I'm in Texas, they probably speak Spanish there. And it was private, and the team at that time was good. But I didn't understand at that time that, yeah, the team was good, but they were losing four seniors. So the team was not going to be really good the next year. So it was okay. So I ended up, you know, taking the SAT in November or October. I didn't get the score, the minimum score by the NCAAs. So the coach goes, look, you have one more shot. That's in December. If you don't pass, then there's not much we can do. The NCAA would not clear you to play. So I went again. At this time, I got to go to Buenos Aires. You cannot even take this test in my hometown. So I got to now drive 3-4 hours to take it. And obviously, my mom, halfway supportive of this, I said, my kid's not going 4 hours away. He's going miles away now. And my dad a little more supportive. So I got the minimum, actually, legitimately the minimum score required. I think was 820 back in the day. And that's what I got, 820, thanks to the math portion. And then January 3rd, I'm going to fly to Houston from Argentina to join Baylor. And interesting enough, so when I get to Baylor, so coach picks me up. I mean, again, I cannot speak English at this time. So season starts in 2 weeks. So I'm 145 pounds. A guy that played maybe 3 matches on hard courts his whole life on red clay. So we got to practice, and I'm just spinning these balls and tossing. My second serve is like a little kick. And the coach goes, I need you to work on warming up. Can you hit your serve? And I say, I'm actually hitting my serve. This is my serve. and so he goes, okay, I think you need to redshirt. I mean, like, you know, the team is in a transition. You know, we're 56th in the country, and not this semester, this season is now we're rebuilding. And I said, look, I came here to play tennis, not really to study. You know, that I just want, I know, and I know how to study, but I want to play tennis. So if I'm going to, and I didn't understand, and you know, I look back now, and that was a mistake by me that I always admit to him. And so I said, look, I want to play. If I'm not going to play, then I go back. The assistant coach played a huge role, Nelson Winterbottom, that ended up being the coach of Colorado and Tennessee later on. She said, look, I help you. Let's go and do one-on-ones, and you know, you're gonna get stronger, you're gonna get better. So at the beginning of the season, I didn't play. I was on the bench until I get a chance to play one match, because one guy gets injured. So I played, they put me at 5, thinking, hey, let's sacrifice this spot a little bit. And then I went in 3 sets. And then from now on, I play the next 13 matches, and I won 13 matches out of 13. And then I just play 5 the whole freshman year. And obviously ended up losing later, you know, to a better teams. And, you know, we made the NCAAs, lost second round and all that. But again, I was the guy that, you know, that some maybe other guys relate, that we go to a restaurant to order food with the team, and I would order whatever the guy next to me would order, because I was too scared to or embarrassed to don't know how to say it. So I would say, oh, what do you want? I want the same as him. I have no idea what the other guy ordered. So I was like, okay, well, hopefully he ordered something good. So I was not very shy and a little bit introvert until, you know, all that kind of pushed me to change. You know? And then that summer, I think, was a big summer for me. I decided to stay a little longer, train, and you know, my English got a little better. But again, the freshman year, I have probably twice the option to kind of, I went to the coach, I said, look, I think this is not for me, I want to go back. And thanks to the support of the coaching staff and the players and the school and the teachers, now I was taking a lot of, that freshman year, a lot of classes that didn't require a lot of reading besides once. I was taking, you know, math classes, I took Spanish. And then, you know, as Baylor, you had to take, you know, some New Testament and all that. And that's pretty hard. You know, you got to read the Bible in English. I cannot even speak English. It's like, but anyway, so there's a lot of, you know, all that. And then, you know, I look back now, it's okay. You know, if I was more conscious of what that was going to look like, I probably wouldn't done it, you know. So it's like, no way. And I think that kind of, you know, being young and a little bit immature and, you know, and just loving the game and wanting to play tennis pushed you to do all that. So. So that's kind of my start, how I got to Baylor, how I survived my first semester and all that. So I became most improved of the team that freshman year. And from now on, then everything got a lot better.
So when you took the ACT, was the ACT in Spanish or English?
English, all
so
English.
So you're having to take a test in a language you don't even speak?
Correctly. So that's why the math portion, you know, was huge. So like the guy said, look, just really focus on the math. Then the other one became kind of, you know, the other portions, you know, probably unfinished some of them. So just try to get some points there. So it was challenging because Baylor, you had to take the TOEFL, which is the, not kind of for second level. But that one, Baylor was able to, don't worry about the score. You got to take a minimum score, but again, if your score is a little on the lower end, then you take English for second language class, and then, you know, you kind of somewhat on probation and all that. And so, but it was not like a strong requirement that you need a certain score on the TOEFL. But the other one, yeah, because it's run by the NCAA. So yeah, that's like, okay, there we go.
But I assume your Spanish class at Baylor, you made an A in.
That was the only A I have in the whole 4 years. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, I passed that one and I took, so all this, there's one I tested out and then the other ones I had to take it, because then you need certain hours to be, again, to be eligible by the NCAA. So we want to secure that, hey, look, you're going to pass these classes. And I laugh now with some of the kids. Now I finished with a 3.2 GPA. And I laugh, guys, I mean, like, if a guy from Argentina that didn't speak any English can get a degree from Baylor, I say, guys, come on. It's like, you can do it. So,
there's no excuse.
It's required effort a little bit. And yeah, I spent time. You know, I was not, likely, you know, Matt Connell, the coach, you know, freshman year, you have to sit on the first three rows of the classroom on every class. And he will walk by, you will see him through, you know, the little corridors. And if not, then there's a morning workout for the whole team. Obviously, if you don't go to class, there's a morning workout at 6 a.m. for the whole team. And as a freshman, you didn't want to be that guy. I mean, you will struggle a little bit. So, but all that, and then, you know, the tutors and the study hall hours, and I was using all of it. I mean, like, and just, yeah, I need help. So, I think that part of being, you know, in a way a little humble, say, look, yeah, I need help, and I will do all the study hall hours that you need me to if I can get through. But again, always on my forefront was, I want to play tennis, you know, and that's what that's how I went there. And then, you know, with time and understanding the system, is okay, yeah, no, let's take care of the school as well. It's important. So
So after your freshman year, I think the Baylor brought in a couple of German players, right? Benjamin Becker and Benedict Dorsch. How good were they when you first saw them?
They were amazing. I mean, they changed the whole program. I mean, they were the reason why, I think, in a way. I mean, there's a lot of good players before that and all that, but these two guys, I think, and you know, now we're 15th in the nation. I started on my sophomore year, and you know, Benedict and Benny show up. I mean, they're guys, you know, they're with experience in club tennis and at a higher level. So all of a sudden now we're going to play UCLA at UCLA and regular season, and we beat them. Because at that time also, you know, those big time schools, they don't want to come to Waco. I say, look, some of the cases, what was UCLA? So you come to UCLA, if you can beat us, then we can go to Waco next year. So now we're fifth in the nation playing this team, they're top 10, and we're winning. So now all of a sudden, I mean, and it's a bunch of guys that all, you know, we have, I think, two Americans at that time out of 9, 10 guys that we all get along, and some of us were in the same boat, you know, with the language or with the culture and all that. So we're helping each other out, and now the season is fun. Now you start winning. That we ended up finishing, I think, five that year. And yeah, and those two guys, I mean, completely changed the program. But they came because there were other Germans in the program, so they recommended. So that's how, you know, the whole thing of having more German guys on the team, that's how it happens, you know, a lot of the schools. So yeah, that's my sophomore year. We ended up losing to USC, Texas A&M, they hosted that year. So, and now that's when the whole thing is starting to be, okay, guys, we're getting better. Now it's doable, you know, and now we have, you know, kids from Hungary, and now we have a kid from Slovenia, we have Croatia and all that. So, all of a sudden there's starting to be a little bit of a belief that we can do something special at Baylor that it hasn't been done. You know, so far, no one team sport has won a national championship at Baylor. Yeah. So and that kind of sense of belief started to be, you know, started to grow a little bit. You know, we're still farther away, but it's starting to grow.
But yeah, but you make a good point that no team at Baylor had won a national championship until your tennis team did it in 2004. And since then, Baylor has, you know, become a national power in basketball, football, and other sports. And you know, you're maybe tennis is the thing that really catapulted the Baylor sports program to know that they can compete at the national level, and gave the other programs something to shoot for.
Absolutely, and I hope, I mean, that was part of it. And then the junior year, I mean, I thought we had a better team or more depth than the year that we won it. Unfortunately, the week before runner 16 was all in top 16, you go to one side. So a week before we're practicing, we're doing just some silly fitness, not just for fun. We're playing tag and running just to get agility. And one guy hits the hand of another guy and breaks a finger. And this guy was playing three for us. And now I was playing four. So all of a sudden we play, this is at Georgia now, you know, and the Nationals and runner 16, we play Alabama and the coach decides to put this guy in, even if he cannot hold the racket, basically it's his pinky. So we win 4-1, he loses his match, and then we're playing Vanderbilt and the quarters, you know, with Bobby Reynolds, and they have an incredible team, and then I'm moving everybody one spot, put us in a tough spot, and it rained and we went indoors and we were a bunch of grinders, I say, clay court. So that whole thing, we collapsed it and we lost, you know, and also was interesting because in that one, there were not a lot of fans of Baylor at Georgia, and there was a ton of people from Vanderbilt, and we experienced something that we were not ready for it. That again, there's six foreign guys in the lineup. You know, there's not one American in the lineup. There are a few Americans on our team, but not on the lineup. And there's a moment that the whole indoor courts of Georgia, they're starting to go USA, USA. Like it was like a USA against, you know, a bunch of foreign guys. And again, we were not ready for it. So it was something that I think stuff like that you know, kind of prepare us for the next year. And saying, okay, guys, I mean, you got to expect the unexpected, you know, to be able to win national championship, I think things need to happen that you got to be prepared and you got to be lucky a little bit, you know. And I think on that one, we were a little unlucky with this player getting injured. But this other stuff kind of toughened us a little bit. I said, guys, I mean, it's not about the U.S. or this or that. It's about, you know, representing your school. And you guys know, you know, half of the players in college tennis these days are all foreign guys. So every team almost has one. So, but for us, it was a little bit shocking because we were not looking at it that way. And the next year, we were lucky enough to get it done. But again, we had depth. I mean, Benedict Dors wins the national championship in singles. So all of a sudden, this group of, you know, of players at the top, they're top in the nation. You know, Benny is top of the nation. So you can see that they have more tools that the guys are playing at 5 and 6, or even at 3, like me, you know. So I think those 1-2 spots, you know, again, us playing Vanderbilt is Benny Becker against Bobby Reynolds, two guys that later on are top 100 in the world.
Right.
You know? And that year, I mean, Illinois wins it undefeated with an incredible team, you know, Brian Wilson, Amadelic, you know. And so I mean, I'm a big believer in college tennis. I think even these days, even more, I think there is a pathway. You got to be playing in the top of the lineup on a school that is top of the nation. And if you're having success, there's a chance that you can go. Obviously, there are cases of players that are not in that same scenario and they still make it. You know, like one of our kids right here that you guys know, Zeke Clark, you know, he's here and the kids asking, you know, young kids, they go saying, you think I can be a pro like you? And what Zeke will say, anybody can make it. It's just, it requires certain things, and are you willing to do so? I mean, and then even that, you don't know, but anybody can be a pro. So that's a little bit, you know, the story. I mean, my senior year, I decided to take the fall off, and I went to Mexico for 13 weeks with very little money. So I spent the summers at Baylor, I wore the camps and save a little money to go. So the coach might have said, look, if you want to try to play afterwards, probably it's a good start to go and take the fall off. And, you know, then it helps the team also. We can bring another guy, blah, blah, blah. So I went by myself and played 12, 11 futures and 2 challengers. So all qualies. I started, at that time, they were one every week in a different city. So we go and play the qualifying on the first one I qualify and I make quarters. So at that time I already get two ATP points. And then, so I lost on a Friday and I had to play the qualifying in the next tournament the next day. So I go to the bus station, take a 19-hour drive on the bus, and then asking, can you put me Saturday the last day, last match on? So, and I did that every single week. I only had 1 week off in between, I think at week seven, which again, when I look back, is the way I did it is not the right way to do it. By that time, that was available. That's what I know. That's the little money I have. So I will sleep in housing. I will share, you know, like a lot of the guys in the world. I'm not the only one doing that at the time. So, but again, out of the 11 futures I play, I qualify in all of them. And that's what got me to 900 and something. So I probably got 10 points, I think it was, or 8 points. Play first round of a challenger and all that. So, and then I get to know Mexico very well. So I was there in every single city until I went back to Argentina that November. And so I was lucky enough, like I say, since I play with all these junior guys, you know, from Argentina, like Coria and Albanian. Coria is from my hometown, so I will go back in December and I will train with him. He was doing preseason training for Australian Open. At this time, he's five in the world. And I say, will you help me? I say, yeah, absolutely. Are you kidding me? So I will go and I think that also helped me that year that I came back in the spring for my senior year. I spent almost every day with him for 20 days training on hardcore because he was, you know, going to Australian Open and, you know, summertime there. So I learned a lot about tennis, about coaching, and went back to my last semester of playing, but I still have another year left of school because I came in January, so I lost my first fall, and then I took the fall off, so I was a year behind kind of in school. So anyways, we play my senior year, and at this time now, from my sophomore, junior, and senior, we're winning the conference, we're winning the conference tournament, so, you know, we're dominating, you know, a little bit the conference to the point that other schools, you know, Texas A&M, they're trying to find ways to, okay, you know, these guys are winning, they have more talent, so, but they're trying to find ways, hey, these guys play club tennis in Germany, they shouldn't be allowed to play, you know, they're breaking rules and all that, so all the whole thing came up, and to the point that, you know, Benny and Doris, they had to sit out for a couple of matches one time because, yeah, they, you know, they play maybe a club match and so on and so on, so those were challenges that we went through. And so my senior year, you know, we were at this point, you know, three in the nation starting the year, and it was, you know, we're playing better and better as the weeks go on and the months goes on, and I don't know, it's just you can kind of see that this is, it's going well, it's going well, and you know, we're winning matches in a way that, you know, is, you can feel that we're walking in. We have a number six guy, Ivo Lovrak. He's Croatian guy, 6'6". So we win the doubles point, and this guy will win in, I don't know, 45 minutes or an hour. So he could be playing as high as three. Like I was playing three. And so all of a sudden, it's like, it's just, we're 2-0. And that confidence carry on that, no, you look across the board, unless I felt that way, that we can win in every single line against any team. So they, you know, sometimes teams feel like, hey, our 5 and 6, no, that's for no struggle. The 1 and 2, you don't know because, no, the competition is high. But that semester, you know, you feel like, hey, we can win in every line. And so, that's how, yeah, everybody.
Yeah, so, Matias, I'm just looking at the 2004 schedule where you guys, you know, you played the Big 12 tournament and the NCAA tournament. You played 8 matches. In those 8 matches, you guys lost a total of 1 point in 8 matches.
Yeah, wow. Against Rice.
Yeah, against Rice, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's how it felt. I mean, the finals against UCLA, it was the second quickest final of the NCAA history. I think it was incredible. I mean, like, and you can feel it. And at least I think us as players, we can feel it. And again, some of that I think is preparation. We train in a way that, you know, the training changed from my freshman year to my senior year in college. We would train, my freshman year, we'd train 4 hours. And it was physical. And, you know, and we would do this morning workouts that, you know, and I understand we're trying to build a team culture, but the guy that's 6'6 and I'm 5'9, super light and fast, we had to do, you know, sprints and all that. And it was the same time for everybody. Doesn't matter if you're 6'6, quick, slow. And you know, and so what trying to be in a team, no culture and all that, but at the same time it was hard. So like, so I think the coach over time understood that, look, the same way that I cannot lift or I cannot serve the same way that this guy is 6'6" serving, he cannot run as fast. There's a, obviously there had to be a minimum. So I think that changed, and now the training became a little more customized. Like, let's do 2.5 hours, well done. And I think that we were prepared. We were like, we had cycle training that that we play. My senior year, we played Texas at home on a Wednesday at 6 p.m. And if we win that, this regular season, if we win that match, we win the regular season, Big 12. If we lose, they win it. And at the day before, we're lifting heavy weights, like we're trying to, you know, whatever, lift the words, and like, and we're sore the next day. But, and he goes that, look, we're not trying to peak tomorrow against Texas. We're trying to peak at the NCAAs. We're trying. So there was all this mental work behind it. You know, we will have, you know, pictures in the locker room, which again, a lot of teams probably doing that, but everything that year was towards, you know, the NCAAs. It was like, hey, we already won the Big 12 multiple times, the tournament. So it's not that we're taking it for granted. I say, no, we're going to leave today, Tuesday, but guess what? Tomorrow you're going to play Texas. I'm expecting you guys to win it. You know, I'm not going to buy into that. I'm sorry, we're sore, but know that we're trying to play the best tennis and be in the best shape for, you know, May. And that kind of, you know, like it or not, makes you, you know, believe that way. And, you know, and Matt, we have this thing, you know, we're in Waco, you know, a lot of people have their vision of Waco. And, you know, and he will tell you every day, look, you are in the best city in the world. You're in the best place in the world. And you hear so many times, then it's like, you start kind of not believing, but say, yeah, I mean, we're in a good place. We're on a good team. We have everything we need, and so on. So I think, you know, that kind of mindset, you know, puts up in a little bit of that we're going and we're just taking care of business in a quick way, right? So that, you know, we'll be UCLA, all these teams, Ohio State, you know, 4-0, 4-0, 4-0, and the NCAA is actually here in Tulsa. So,
So Matias, let me ask this question. So just kind of transitioning, the transition you had into American college tennis is fascinating. I mean, showing up, not being able to speak the language, afraid to order food, and then you end up 4 years later a national champion. How did those experiences and the things you learned, like periodization, your coach was basically periodizing y'all where you would peak at one time.
Correct.
How, you know, thinking about now what you're doing, working as the director of and am I saying this right? The director of an academy.
Yes.
How did that experience impact what you do now? Because one of the things I've noticed about you is, because you had such a broad range of experience, most of the things I've ever even brought up to you, you already know the answer to, you've already experienced it. And as many gold ball and silver ball and bronze ball kids as you've had, 12, 14, 16, 18s, it's almost like nothing that we could ask, you haven't already experienced. How did your upbringing and your experience at Baylor prepare you for what you're doing now?
I think huge. I mean, like, and I didn't know at that time, you know, like, hey, tennis coaching is going to be my career, you know, like, again, I was just playing tennis, but again, I learned a lot by observing, and other people know me, you know, I'm more, like I said, I'm the quiet, and I observe a lot, and I look back, you know, from Matt, you know, my coach at Baylor, you know, like, he was, you know, that kind of, you know, periodization and training, you know, with a purpose, and being on time. I mean, that was huge for me, and that, like, you know, if we're 1 minute late, you know, obviously if we're on time, we're late and all that, but and stuff like that that I try to, you know, live by, and I try to install on the kids, you know, that prepare them for college and all that. And, you know, and I was lucky enough, like I said, to be exposed to a lot of different areas, I think, of the tennis, you know, from the juniors now here at the club, from experiencing some of, you know, myself playing a little bit of, you know, of pro and traveling with some pro players, you know, I'll have the chance to, like I say, you know, Corey, you know, a good friend, and experiencing practice time with him. Later on, actually, I worked for, he built an academy in Argentina, and I worked 3 years with him there. traveling to a Masters when the Masters was in Houston with him, you know, as a friend, not as a coach, but being able to be close to, you know, with Benny Becker. I know I traveled with him to the US Open when he played Djokovic and lost second round, you know, because Benny didn't have a coach and said, look, will you help me? And, you know, more as a friend than actually a coach, because I was just, you know, starting my coaching career. But those experiences, you know, I felt pretty lucky, you know, like, you know, because you can go, like the example with Benny, I could have gone and Benny could have lost first round to someone, okay, but he ended up winning the first round. Second round, he plays Djokovic and Artur Ashe. So with all that thing that, you know, that means with it, you know, like my wife that was, you know, top 100 in the world, and I traveled with her also to some pro tournaments. You know, we have this other Argentinian guy, Renzo Olivo, that came and actually and trained here at the academy for a few weeks because I know him from my home. And I say, can you travel with me to Indian Wells and help out? And I learned a lot about those moments because it's different, no? And I don't consider myself a coach for the pro tour because there is so much to it. But I learned, you know, like on those guys are like, you know, in the top 100, top 50, the information that needs to be given, it needs to be very precise and short and not too much. When in the juniors, you know, you're more in the developing stages and that maybe, you know, you can do more changes. And so every part of the, you know, of the development of a player is different. So I was, again, lucky myself to get the chance to be exposed to it and be exposed to these coaches. You know, when Correa, I'm training with him prior to Australian Open and I'm in my hometown, his coach is Alberto Mancini, who was top 10 in the world. And he's coaching this guy. So for me, it's like, it's fascinating, you know, to be able to spend time with him on the court, you know. And then you come back here to the U.S. and now we're a regional training center for the USTA. So I get the chance to go to Orlando or back in the day to Boca and spend time with Jose Higueras, you know, who, you know, is trying to raise the level of coaching in the US, or Andy Brandy. So all those for me they were mentors in a way that probably they didn't know they were mentoring me, because me watching them, I learned so much. You know, it's not like someone, hey, this is your mentor assigned. So I just, you know, I have a lot of those that I just watch and learn. And then some others I watch and learn what not to do, right? So that I don't agree with what they do. So I think it's also part of it that I actually give them value too. So,
Well, I got a comment first. So Scott actually went and pulled up the match that you mentioned, and you mentioned the day, and we're going back to college. You mentioned the day and the time of the match and against Texas, right, Scott?
Yep. Wednesday, 6 p.m.
Yeah, I mean, literally, you nailed it. It was Wednesday.
I'm not making this up. I swear, I'm not making this up.
But that, I'm not, I know you're not making it up. What's impressive is that was in what, 2004?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't tell you where I was yesterday, and you're telling me the day, the time. That's incredible. I think so. The next question is: tell us a little bit about what you're doing at the academy. Talk to us a little about the programming, the kids that have come through in the past. What some of y'all's philosophies are, because the detail oriented that I see from you, and then hearing you even remember a time that was 19 years ago, you knew the day, the time. I've never seen somebody, at least in tennis, who is as methodical and detail oriented as you are. So tell me a little bit about Tucker Tennis Academy and what you do there.
So I joined Tucker Tennis in 2012. So to be honest, by accident a little bit. So I'm in Argentina working for the Guillermo Cuerdas Academy. My wife, Georgie, is, you know, retiring from pro tennis. And she was like, I want to live abroad. I said, well, if we're going to go abroad, probably the U.S. would be a good place since, you know, I've lived there for 6 years and you like it. And she played a lot of tournaments here. So, okay, so we ended up moving to Florida, small academy that didn't work out. It was not what we're looking for. So we're there for a month and a half and saying, look, this is not for us. So at that time, I called the Baylor coach, Matt, and said, look, no, this is March, April time. I said, look, either I go back to Argentina and no, it's okay. We tried, it didn't work. Or maybe I get into college coaching at the time. But I said, Matias, until June, that's one open up, you won't know. I said, but I know this guy, Trent Tucker, who has his academy in Tulsa. And the connection between Matt and Trent is Trent played for Kansas University back in the day. And Matt at that time was assistant coach for him. So So I said, look, you play for me, blah, blah. So I called Trent. I said, look, me and my wife were coaches, you know, and he goes, for sure. I mean, let me see what I can do. I would love to have you. I mean, like, there are not many females, former top 100 in the world, that want to be coaching in tennis and having you with your experience and all that. So at that time, we start all the paperwork and visa that and all that. So we're just, so I went to Texas and I'm just floating, right? Like waiting for the visa to get approved. So kind of a little mini vacation with no money, with no nothing, with my wife. I didn't have kids at the time, so that worked out. So until we get the paperwork approved and we moved to Tulsa. So, and we just started like regular tennis coaches. Hey, look, this is not what we do. We have this philosophy of the academy, and this is the groupings and all that. So, I started working. I started just doing the groupings, having private lessons to my wife, and we do what most of the young pros do, at the age of 23. But at the time, I was 30 with a little bit more experience because I already worked in a few places, not in the U.S. Actually, I worked in the U.S. in Brookhaven back in after college for a year. So then we started working and I'm again hungry to make a name for myself on the tennis world, right? So I want to coach and I want to inspire kids and I want to work with high performance but I was doing everything and my wife was doing everything. So with time, I think Trent saw in me some of the things that you just mentioned, got this kid's a little organized, this coach also, and he started including me more and more in the business part of it, hey, Matias, join me in this meeting with this parent. Hey, Matias, join me in this, conversation with the USTA. And then, after probably 3 years or so, I became a little bit of his, right-hand man on the academy, which is not easy. You understand, there are coaches here at that time that they've been here for 12, 14 years, right? And then Trent is giving me the opportunity that, I don't know, he either saw something, like I say, or trusted his God that said, look, I can help him in something that maybe he was lacking or he was looking for years. And that's how my role grew a little bit. Now I'm director of high performance in that time. So, and that's when I really started doing some of this stuff that you mentioned, doing the periodization, which is, by the way, extremely hard in U.S. junior tennis. It's better now, but it used to be back in the days really hard because the kids were playing ITF sectionals. U.S. is crazy, so there's impossible to periodize. But again, so all that until COVID hits and Trent decides to retire and kind of move out of the academy, move to Tahoe, California, and he's still as a consultant. And then back at that time, in 2019, I take the job of director of tennis. So what does it mean? We have 15 coaches on the staff between tennis and fitness, a facility with 21 courts, 12 outdoor tarts, 3 outdoor clay, 6 indoor. It's just tennis and fitness, this club, there's no all the other sports. And so very family oriented, owned by a family that is super supportive to what we do, the Pellegrinis. And actually, their son trained with us for years before he went to play college tennis at Bryant. And that's what we do. We are, people say, how do you get so many players out of little town like Tulsa, right? Like, why not Florida? Why not California?
And Matias, that was my question, but go ahead.
Yeah. So there is no secret sauce. There's no secret. We don't have anything that we just throwing the kids. I think, it's, number one, when Trent set up, he set up in a situation that him as a director was not about making this big amount of money. Hey, I want to make all this money. And then so he was more like, look, I want to bring better coaches, which I think the USTA was doing as well, with the RTCs and all that. We got to improve the level of coaching in the country, like, besides that things are not too spread out and it's not easy, it's such a large country. So, but he said, let's get better coaches. And so with that, and then I think the environment, so he created an environment that, it's competitive on the high performance side, because that's the other thing. We have recreational tennis, we have under 12, we got to the point now that if a kid walks into this club, I don't care the age, I don't care the level. There is a class for you, and there is a place for you, and there are goals for you. That doesn't have to be to win a gold ball. I don't care. I mean, like, if you tell me, look, I want to, you know, I want to get to A to C, from A to B. Okay, fine. And that's the success. I mean, for me, that's, I celebrate that as much as, you know, these other ones that is always maybe have more recognition, that is not being top 10 in the country and so on. So all that, I mean, with, I think, a little bit of a structure that we didn't have in the past, meaning that now we have a pathway, you know, that you can choose to go, or your level of tennis will tell you where you land, and just continue to, I think we try so many different things over the years, and again, now when Trent was here, I was more the guy on the field, and now the boots are there, and he would be a little more like, hey, what do we try this, and we'll try, and we fell in so many different ways on how to do groupings and how to do things and all that. But again, we got to the point now that I think the system that we have from a structure, from classes to the teaching a little bit, which we incorporate a lot from the USTA. You know, I think being a regional training center helped us a lot to get organized, you know, and we will go to, you know, to Boca back in the days, and there are 24 academies, and then hey, you guys have to develop your vision, your mission. What are your core values, you know, and stuff that, you know, I mean, I didn't think about it. And I think, I don't know, a lot of academies probably don't do that. You know, what are we trying to teach the kids to live through when they get even past college? Because, I mean, the truth is, how many, you know, college kids turn pro? It's a small number. It's a pathway if you want to go, but it's not like, you know, 30% of them go pro. I would say maybe 5% or less. So, and then these kids become part of society. So what are we trying to teach them besides having a good junior career, whatever that means for everybody, but also, you know, the core values that, no. So we're starting defining all that and trying to now, okay, now we have a little bit of a vision that's more clear on what do we want to do, you know? And if you go on our website, you know, it's, you know, to develop world-class players and world-class people, you know, and I'm a big advocate of that. I think you got to be a good person to be a good player. Some people might disagree. There are exceptions, yes, but I think it's a lot easier to become a better player if you're a good person. So I think that's what we do. We mix them up, and as you guys know, we mix up groups. We have kids that I see, Clark, who's here this week, kid that's 450 in the world and 200 in doubles. He's doing drills like the kid that's a 3 UTR. Are they going to share the same court? Probably not, but they're going to do the same warm-up? Yes. So, and that's, for me, is priceless, you know? And so all of a sudden, I think people ask me, what's the difference between your academy and the rest? I think the depth of players that we have, you know, and of course they have, you know, you have cycles. No, there is some age groups that were not as deep anymore, and that's okay. And maybe because we didn't do a great job 4 years ago on the under 12, and now we're paying the consequences, or because of, you know, whatever, you know, 7 years ago, we have a tremendous amount of girls, you know, we have, I don't want to name all of them because I'm going to miss some of them, but from Vanessa on, Emma Staker, Gracie Epps. So all these girls are like, you know, in the 15 to 17, they're all top 20 in the country, and we have 6 of them. And it's not easy. As you know, dealing with girls is competitive and all that. But like, yeah, these girls, they went, one went to UCLA, the other one went to Wake Forest, the other one went to OU, Ole Miss, Kentucky, Grace is going to Georgia. So we're talking about big Power 5 schools. So to have all those girls training, I mean, again, it was not easy, but it was a lot of fun, you know. And now we have that depth on the boys. Now, and in the past too, you know, with Nathan Hans and Pierce Rawlings, like, as I'm speaking to you, I see Pierce Rawlings over here in the gym, and he's not, the breaks, they come here, you know. So we have a culture and environment that I think Trent saw that vision back in the day, and he started, and I think we're trying to continue that. You know, the kids, you know, as you know, Nicholas Hang, you know, went to Auburn, and he's coming for a week this summer. And Waleed, who is at Dartmouth, he's coming 2 weeks this summer. Luke Braggs, that is at Wichita State, he's coming here for 2 weeks. So for me, that's, I mean, I don't know, it's a special, you know. So I tell the kids, you know, this is a ladder. You know, someone is pulling you up, but you got to bring someone up as well from the bottom. So if we all do that, then, you know, we help each other out. And it's not as smooth as every day. There are obviously, you know, days that we don't do a good job, and and all that. And I tell you an example was, this was about 2 months ago. It was raining here in Tulsa, and somehow we have 8 guys training on 4 indoor courts. So 2 kids a court. That day we open new balls. And these kids are like Zeke Clark, who's 450 in the world. Ian Bragg, just one Easter ball, you know, one in the nation in 16s. Then you have kids like Lawson, Kale, Landon. These kids are all top 50 in the US in 16s and 18s. And these guys are like complaining. And I was like, guys, I mean, so we stopped practice and say, what else you guys need? Because at this point, I don't know what else. You have 3 coaches, no, 2 coaches in that practice. So it's, hey guys, 4 course, new ball, 2, all good. So, and then having someone like Z kind of being able to say something and all that, I don't know. I don't think many places can say that. And again, and it's genuine. It's not like, you know, these kids care, you know, and Z start walking and saying, you know, asking little Peter, who just won the L5, hey, that was amazing, good job. I was like, I don't know, for me, that's what it makes this place, I think, special, back to your question. And Tulsa is, it's a cheap city, you know, in a way. So it's a family, you know, it's considered small that you go to other big, massive academies, you know, when you go on court 45 with a coach, I don't know. I mean, like, you know, if he's going to pay a lot of attention to you and you spend a lot more money. So, so I don't know. I think that's a fit for everybody. Probably not, but it's working. So, and that's our goal, to continue to make it work with the kids that we have and continue to bring the best coaching staff. I think that's important. And I think that applies for, you know, I don't know, college coaching, you know. I think the schools are doing well. They have a good head coach, but also they have a good assistant. So, you know, and a good volunteer. So, I mean, you know, in a different setup, right? But we try to, you know, and we have a lot of coaches movement, you know, over the years and COVID play part of it. But I think right now we're in a spot that our coaching staff is premature. I would say all of them want to be tennis coaches. So there are more, you know, some of them with kids playing tennis in our program. So then things, you know, are in a good spot right now. And so it's just kind of keeping the car on the highway, make sure it doesn't fall to the side a little bit, right? So, which again, it's not easy, but that's a little bit of the day-to-day operation of what we do here. And again, there are issues there, and there are complaints about, hey, my son or my daughter should be in this group. And I always go back to the same comment, was your kid in a good training group? You know, he or she had a good training practice with the people or the players that they have? And if the answer is yes, don't worry about the rest. Don't worry about if they're playing at 7:20 UT, who cares, you know, get a good practice. And right. If not, then, like, you know, and I put example, you know, Nathan Hamm back in the day was the best one. So then he has no one to practice, and Zeke Clark and Nico Hang and, you know, and so on. You can get a good practice. Now, I understand maybe the match play setup. Yeah, maybe we need to find, you know, when Zeke comes in town, we need to find a little bit more, you know, match play opportunities for him, because, you know, he's better than the rest of the guys. So, but again, so, I don't know if that answers your question, but...
It makes perfect sense. You know, one of the things I thought was real impressive, when we reached out to y'all, y'all were very much, no problem is not overcomable. And what I mean by that is, you know, we're sitting in a city 8 hours away, and our son wants to come full time. How do you do that? And what I loved about communicating with you and the folks at the academy was, as long as we would just tell you the issue, y'all would have a solution. So, well, we don't know where Everett or Luke or whoever can stay. Well, okay, well, we can board. We'll find somebody to board them, or we'll find a coach for them. Like, y'all have found a way to make it work. How important has the boarding thing been to y'all, and why haven't y'all transitioned maybe to a dorm model? And I've asked you this before, but I want everybody to kind of hear the answer about the dorm versus the host family. But I think it's real impressive that if anybody out there is thinking about trying it, whatever barriers they view, y'all have a solution around most of those barriers, which I was very impressed with. So talk a little bit about the barriers and how y'all got to that point, but then also your philosophy around hosting versus dorms.
Yeah, I mean, to the first question, I mean, again, it's a group of not just coaches, I think, you know, from these people and the management that we care. I mean, like, that's the reality at the end of the day. I think it's kind of as simple as that, that, you know, and I know how it is, and I know how it is to move out of your hometown to train, because I live in myself in Argentina, and I know it's not easy. So we want to facilitate that and explore every single option we can. And it's not about like, hey, we need to do that because we got to get this kid here so he can pay or she can pay and get more money. We're lucky in a way that, you know, the owner that we have, obviously there is a revenue component that he keeps an eye, but he's like, Matias, I want to support. So it's like, if that's what it takes. So we try to explore options, you know, and not the door might be an issue, or it might be, you know, I can only come X amount of days per week, or I can only come this week, but not next week. That's fine. I mean, we're big, but small enough that we can customize the training based on the needs that we think is appropriate for you. Now, if you come and tell us that you want this and we don't believe in that, we're going to tell you that this is not the place for you. And it happens in the past, you know, not many times, but, you know, I don't think this is not the place for you, because we know that we won't be able to help you. But on the dorm and stuff, I mean, I don't know. I've seen enough places where you put your kid on the dorm in an academy and the supervision is very minimum. And that's when things go wrong quickly. And all of a sudden, you know, they're not doing what they need to be doing. They're not eating what they need to be eating. So I had a chance that the owner said, Matias, I can build dorms. I mean, we have space to the club. So I said, I don't want it. The liability and I wouldn't feel comfortable if I was my kid also to be in there, because unless we're going to spend all this money on having supervision, I mean, everything that requires, which is pretty hard. And then now the it doesn't work. So I said, look, I don't know. I'd rather have host families. So we explore that. So, you know, together with Tiffany, who you guys know, you know, that that's an amazing job. So we started working on reaching out to people and say, you know, and even sometimes coaches, you know, that are willing to house the kids and say, look, will you guys be open? And then we found that a lot of people were open to it. I would say not a lot, but enough that we can house and take care of the demand. And for me, now that makes a difference. Now the kid, instead of being in a dorm with other young kids, kind of, you know, not fully unsupervised, but with a lot of freedom, now is in a family and having a dinner with a, you know, stepmom, stepdad, and all that. And again, and most of the families are members of our club, and they have a, you know, a daughter or son in the program. And I said, yeah, I would love for that. And we have experiences that, you know, because no, we have one kid that was there and Nico stayed with him, and Nico inspired this kid to play tennis. And this kid is playing soccer and tennis and basketball, and slowly is probably gonna play only tennis, you know, and okay, that's a win-win. And you know, and so all the things, I think they were more, you know, more value to me, and it felt better, and it seemed better than just having dorms. And of course, you know, the families have to pay the families, and for us it's not a business, it's more a service. I say, look, I want you to have peace of mind. And it's probably the most complicated part of the puzzle when we have kids from out of town, you know, because it's not easy. It's not one thing is have to come for a week. One thing is this family commits for a year, you know. So when you think about it, this new kid that, of course, they get to know and all that, is going to be 24/7 in your house. So we're grateful for the families. I think, you know, that they did do that. And sometimes, I mean, I think for the most part, it goes pretty well. Sometimes, you know, there are issues and all that. And the same with coaches. You know, we have this summer, we have a lot of kids from our town. You know, we're pretty close to Texas and Arkansas and all that. And the kids come for 2 or 3 weeks. And some of the coaches say, look, I can house them. And we say, okay, this is the price. And they provide, you know, the breakfast and maybe the dinner and the transportation, and the families directly, you know, work with them. It's not that for us is a revenue, you know, stream for it. So again, that's what we believe in it. And again, so when we do things, you know, we say, well, we try to find solutions. It's part of what we're trying to teach the kids and the coaches. And I tell the coaches, you know, what are your non-negotiables? You know, what as a coach, you know, you have to have your non-negotiables. For me, a big one is you need to be on time for your practice. If it's a lesson, you can't just show up at 2:30 if your lesson at 2:30. So that people say, oh, Matias, well, that, I don't know, maybe I learned that from college or the way I am, but that's for me, it's a non-negotiable. I mean, like, trying hard is a non-negotiable. So a kid that, I mean, you can have emotions, you can, you know, behavior, we can work through that, but you better try. So and I tell the coaches, I mean, you need to define what are those when you start working with a kid, right? So I think it's important, you know, and how you define that based, you know, based on what who you are as a coach. I mean, there are certain things that we do as a group, we teach a certain way and all that. Now, that doesn't mean that every kid plays the same way. That doesn't mean that every kid has the same forehand grip. I mean, there's, you know, there has to be a little bit of freedom to know, hey, the kid has this, it's okay. Now we're going to keep an eye on our side of the parameters that, you know, the swing path and the grips are in what we think is correct. But no, we're not going to make you do everything the same as everybody else, because I don't think that's how it works. And the same, I mean, I was a pure aggressive baseliner that developed a lot more transition to the net over time in college. But again, I'm working with a kid that's 6'6", that serves on volley every time. And that's, for me, it's fun, because now I got to get out of my comfort zone as a coach and learn, okay, what is this look like? Because I've never played. I can serve on volley, yeah, but that was not my strength. And that's, I think, you know, that together with learning personalities, how you approach a kid at one moment is different, right? Like, I can go pretty harsh to some kids and they will raise to the occasion, and some one-on-ones, if I go the same way, they will cry and call the parents and I will be in trouble. So I think that's the art of the tennis coach. And in the academy setup, you know, it's like you go from, in the 9-10 hours that you're on court or whatever the day, you go from a high-performing kids, like, you know, there's top 10 in the nation in boys 16s, to the next 2 hours to go to the under 12, where you know you're with orange and green and developing, and then maybe you get one adult role that, you know, that's competitive, but so switching hats and all that. So,
oh yeah, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, it's not that easy. And no, sometimes people that from the outside, they see you doing hand feeding and racket feeding, they say, oh, I can do that, you know, I'm gonna go and watch my kids' lesson and I'm gonna do the same. And yes, but there's a little more than that, you know. It's a little bit why you feed the ball and how you feed it based on what the needs are. And sure, you know, I learned that a lot from Andy Brandy and, like I said, from Jose Higueras in the past. Not like there's a lot of over coaching many times, you know, the coaches like to talk a lot, and instead of just letting the drill do the talk, you know, man, yeah, you gotta give instructions and say one or two things, but then while you're doing the drill should kind of itself fix the issue, because if nothing broken, I think improve or get what you're trying to get out of that practice.
Sure, reinforce the skill you're trying to reinforce.
Yeah, that's to get the job done, you know, whatever it is you're working on. So all that stuff, I think, is important, you know, when coaching comes in play. You know, it's not easy, you know, and the kids go in different waves, from gross birth to emotions to off course stuff that's gonna affect them. So it's not as easy as just like, hey, I'm gonna go and feed balls and say move your feet. So
well, and I think Scott has one of the best stories I've heard. There was a parent, I won't say who the kid or the parent was, but they had rented what are those, like, apartments behind the courts right there?
Oh.
And Scott told me the story. He said when Luke and his son were there, he said one of the parents was sitting on the back porch watching the practice and yelled out to his son, "Move your feet, move your feet." And one of y'all looked up and said, "We got this. We'll take care of it."
Yeah, it was funny because this kid was from out of town, and they move here and they rent an apartment that actually overlooks at the court. So he would get there at 3 a.m. with his chair and the coffee. And again, he was the great. I mean, he was the guy. I know exactly who you're talking about. But he was trying to get the kids, like, come on, move your feet. And so, come on. It's like, do you want to call the apartment complex and say that you're disturbing practices? but yeah, no, I think
he had his chair and his coffee.
That's, yeah, great. I know. He's just drinking his coffee and his kids. So, but again, it's the, no, like, you know, it's a triangle, you know, coaches, kids, parents. I mean, like, it's important. I mean, and I think another one why we're successful, we have a great group of parents. I mean, like, that, you know, there are moments of the process that there are doubts. There are moments of the process that they're more intense. There are moments of the process that they question things, fairly so. But again, our answer is the same. You know, the trust and, you know, and just wait, you know, a little bit and just give us time. And then with a little more time, then you can say, yeah, you know, there are going to be things that couldn't have been done better and all that. But the beauty that maybe in, of here that other places is that there are not many options, right? You can maybe go to Dallas, which is 4 hours away. Like if you're in Florida or if you're like, you know, in a bigger city, now there are like 6, 7, 8 academies that you can go and try out. So there are a few here in town, but again, so we think we're better, and then some of them go and try them out and say like, so that kind of a little bit forces you to stay longer in the process. And then they realize like, you know, God, we're lucky that, you know, that we didn't have that many other options, you know, unless you gotta move out of town. And a lot of our kids are like, you know, on the high performance, they live probably like in a 3 mile radius from the club, right? So they're all local kids, and then we have families that they move here and then they become locals in a way. And I think the, you know, the word, the mouth to mouth, I think that's, you know, huge for us because of those things, you know, how we do things. And again, we don't get it right all the time, that's for sure. We probably screw up more often than we think. And then, but anyway, make it a little more of a family place, and yeah, that works.
Well, Matias, like I say, I've been super impressed with what you guys do there, and you're not just pulling in, you know, people that are local, even though a lot of your success does come from kids that are local, like Zeke and others. But, you know, your reputation is national because of what you guys are doing on the national scene, that you are developing, you know, gold ball winners, high D1 players, college players of all levels. So, you know, it's no surprise that people from, you know, Florida, South Carolina will look at Tucker, will go to Tucker. And I think, you know, your backstory, the story that you gave us about, you know, how you grew up and how you became a coach, just speaks to, you know, what kind of program you're running there. And it's no surprise that you're continuing to run with the ball that Trent started there. So, you know, we love, you know, what you guys are doing there. And I think that it's really impressive and what you guys do. But how can parents or anyone else get in touch with you? You know, maybe give them the website, give them a contact number if they're interested in learning more about Tucker.
The website, I mean, first, thank you for your words. I appreciate it. I think the website is one. They can get my email is Matias@RAH, racketandhealth9191.com. Once I get here, we just, you know, we always tell, come and try it, you know, and come for a day. You don't even have to pay for a day if you want to. Just come and try it. And then the other thing is like, you know, you get access. You get access to my phone number. You get access to, you know, all the coaches. So we're pretty open on what we do. So I think, yeah, you can use my email. The club number as well, if you want to, but it goes to the front desk. That's 918-298-9500. But I think email or the website, and yeah, I mean, we love what we do, and we continue to try to improve it year by year. And that's all the things I think we like to do. I think it's just to try things out a little bit, you know, which at the GM is not very happy sometimes because we're trying to change too much too often. But again, tennis evolve. I think academies evolve. And again, and some people like more the 101 setup, you know, and that's okay too. I think at the end of the day, you need to know if you're a parent, what works best for your kid. What is it that you're looking for? You know, based on their age and their stage and their, you know, like if your kid's a freshman or a sophomore, well, the recruiting process would play a big part of it, you know, and you know it is because the anxieties, you know, and all that stuff of what it is, the stress, you know. And so just knowing what you're looking for, and if we can help, we're here and we would love to do it. So I appreciate you guys, you always, you know, giving us a chance and to do that with your kids, and I know you're a good ambassador for what we do, so I appreciate you.
Yeah, thanks so much for being on, and we'll add the academy number to the show notes and also your email. So if anybody listening wants to get a hold of you and they didn't write it down, they can get it in the show notes. But again, thanks so much. You know, when I was working in the school district that I worked in, I was always looking for people that I called fully realized, people that I felt like had walked it and been through it and had enough experiences to really understand the full cycle of what they're trying to do, whether that's a football coach, a teacher, or whatever it is. And one of the main things that I noticed from the academy is there's just a lot of people who are fully realized, people who have been through the whole thing. And there's nothing that you're, that they're going to face with your child that they hadn't faced with somebody else's child already. And I think that's a big benefit, because a lot of the, like you said, a lot of the pros across the country, when they get a top player, it's the first top player they've ever had. But for y'all, it's just another one of the top players that are going to put a gold ball in the trophy case that I see every time we walk in there. So for me, the value was being able to interact with pros and individuals that this wasn't their first rodeo, and are fully realized.
Yeah, and also, and thank you. And also, I think just for me, it's like, you know, some people go, what's the best advice you can give the parents? I think find a coach, whatever, if it's here or somewhere else, doesn't matter. Find a coach that you trust, that is a good person first, that will care about your kid, and that you think has knowledge. And then just move to the side a little bit. Let that coach, you know, work with your kid. You have a role, yes, is to support, is to, you know, from financially to emotionally to drive your kid. It's not enough, but find that person wherever you are that, you know, that you can trust, that will develop the player, but also the person. And so for me, that's the number one thing, right? So if you can get that in your hometown, amazing, you know. And again, obviously, then the, like you say, that experience and the level of, depends how good the kid is getting, that you might have to explore the options as well. But that for me goes a long way. And yeah, and we've been through a lot. And if we have someone that we haven't experienced, that would be even more exciting, a new challenge, and we'll take it with open arms. That's that would be fun as well. So, but yeah, I appreciate you guys, all your kind words.
Yes, sir. Well, thanks so much for being on. And we want to file this episode with one where we're going to interview some folks from the academy and just talk academy. Today was more about Matias's story and kind of how he got into what he was doing, but want to thank him for being on. Scott, enjoyed it. Yep. And can't wait to see y'all in the next episode.